This is Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women. I'm going to be interviewing Andrew Weil, primarily as a source for the history of his grandfather, Elio Weil. I am Gabrielle Denman. I will be the interviewer. Mary Harrison will be the recorder. Now, Andy, we've got to test you, see if your voice is coming through. Could you please tell us your grandfather's full name, the date and place of his birth?
Yes, his birth name was Adolphus Leo Weil, which he very early in his life changed to Elio Weil. And he was born on July 19, 1858.
Where was he born?
He was born in Keysville, Virginia, a small town about 75 miles southwest of Richmond.
Okay. Now, can you go back and tell us about his parents and maybe even his grandparents? How far back can you go? And try and do it, you know, paternal side first, maternal second, or vice versa.
My grandfather's father, my great-grandfather, was Isaac L. Weil. He was born in 1822 in Illerichen, I-L-L-E-R-E-I-C-H-E-N, in Bavaria, about 15 miles south of Ulm, U-L-M. And his wife's name was Leah, L-E-A, and my grandfather had a sister, Hannah, and a brother, Jonas. And they left Bavaria in 1839. When I say they, my great-grandfather, Isaac, who was 17 at the time, and his brother Jonas, who was 21. They left and came to America. Should I just continue on?
Surely.
They arrived in Baltimore, and from there traveled on to Richmond, where they arrived in 1839 and remained in Richmond, Virginia, until 1850, from 1839 to 1850, and they joined the Beth, B-E-T-H, Ahava, A-H-A-B-A, congregation in Richmond. And there are certain records which I was able to locate in their archives at the Beth Ahava Museum, where they have various records. I have photocopies, which I was able to make and brought here, showing when he became naturalized. Now, on December 10th of 1844, after he'd been in America 5 years, he was eligible to become a naturalized citizen. And he declared his intention in 1845, at the age of 22, he became a naturalized U.S. citizen. In 1850, his brother Jonas died in a cholera epidemic in Richmond. And that's when, at the age of 28, my great-grandfather Isaac moved to this little town of Keysville in the heart of tobacco country. Back at that time, Virginia was the largest tobacco growing state in the country, and Southwest Virginia, which was called the Southside, was the heart of large tobacco plantations. And my great-grandfather opened up a little country store in Keysville to service these, to provide all the sorts of goods, hardware and clothing. It was a general store that this little town and the tobacco plantations really needed at that time to previously traveling salesmen would come from Richmond and would travel around and service the demand.
So what was he doing in Richmond before he went to Keysville?
As best I can determine, he worked in a store.
I see.
In a similar type of store in Richmond during the 10 years he was there.
And when did he marry?
Now, in 1853, he returned to Germany. His father died, I presume, because he learned that his father had become ill, because he died shortly after his visit. So he went back to Germany to visit his family and to see his father while he was still living. And there he met Minna Weil, probably a distant relation, I presume in the little towns of Altenstadt, Niederrhein, and Huerben, where she was from, H-U-E-R-B-E-N. H-U-E-R-B-E-N. My great-grandmother was 16 at the time, and Isaac married Minna while he was over there, and then brought her back to this country in 1853, and her younger brother Samuel, who was 15, came along, and they returned to Keysville. And in 1854, their first child, Nathaniel, who is my uncle, was born, my great-uncle. In 1856, they had a daughter, Hannah, and then on July 19, 1858, my grandfather, Elio Weil, was born. I have visited Keysville, and the population today is hardly any larger than it was back at the time that my grandfather was born. It's still a tiny little town. And I was able to look up the records there and find out that my great-grandfather had bought a 309-acre tract for $2,400.
Wow.
On the Keysville-Charlotte Courthouse Road. Charlotte Courthouse is the capital, or the county seat. And it's has a pretty little courthouse. I can show you a picture of it that I took of the courthouse. It was designed by Thomas Jefferson. Oh. And they say that Thomas Jefferson designed just about every building built in Virginia.
Think that's true?
Well, he designed the University of Virginia, you know that, and the Capitol, too. Their home was about a mile and a half from the center of Keysville. So as my grandfather, when he was a small boy, he had very few playmates other than his brother and sister. It was too far to go anywhere, really. So other than children at the school he went to, he wouldn't have had many playmates. In April of 1861, Virginia voted to secede from the Union. That was really the beginning of the Civil War, 1861. So during that period of until 1865, I think the war terminated, my father was growing up during a wartime when there were a lot of hardships. People didn't have very much food. Necessities were very scarce. people use plants to make medicine. The army, the Confederacy needed blankets and shoes and everything, so people were, they had wooden shoes, you know, wore wooden shoes. The Dutch weren't the only ones that had wooden shoes. It was a period of extreme hardship. Keysville wasn't in the heart of, there were many battles fought throughout Virginia, but Keysville was a little bit southwest of any of the major battles, so there was only one Civil War skirmish that took place when the northern troops occupied the town and tore up the railroad.
Do you have any records about the family's feeling about South and North, where their allegiance was?
My grandfather used to tell stories that he'd heard his parents talking. His uncle Samuel was 22 years old when he volunteered as a private in the Charlotte Rifles, which is a company that was organized in Charlotte County. It was Company K in the 18th Virginia Regiment, which became a very famous regiment in the Confederate Army. General Pickett, when he was a colonel, was a regimental commander, and later became a division commander, and the 18th Regiment was part of his division, and so they were in the forefront of many of the famous battles in the Civil War. Bull Run, which was Manassas, the Peninsula Campaign, and Antietam. And Samuel became a lieutenant and was wounded two or three times in these battles. But of course, the family, because of his career, would have been very loyal to the South. And a friend of mine down who lives in Keysville today has some of the family history. He's the sort of a local, he's an attorney and a local historian. Colonel Spencer, who was Samuel's commanding officer, said he was the bravest man he'd ever met. So, of course, the family was very proud of Samuel. But there was a northern branch of the family. My great-grandmother's side came over in the 1840s and settled in Rochester, New York. So there was a branch of the Weil family consisting of a brother of my great-grandmother, several brothers, who came and settled in Rochester and were reasonably successful there and had a bottling plant, made soft drinks. And they, of course, wrote letters to the family in Virginia and tried to get them to come north.
This is during the war?
During the war.
Okay.
But my great-grandfather's loyalties were, he didn't believe in slavery, although they owned slaves. They thought it was an evil institution. But the people were nice to them. If you can imagine living in the midst of, I think there was a population in the county of maybe 10,000 people in the whole county, of which maybe 2,000 or 3,000 were white people and the others were blacks. But these were old Virginia families with, names like Bedford, Bruce. Bruce became, one of the descendants of the Bruce family became ambassador and married Ailsa Mellon.
That's right.
Carrington, Hannah, Pettis, Reed, Watkins, and here's a Jewish, German-Jewish family plunked down in the middle of all these old Revolutionary War prominent names, and would have been a lonely, somewhat lonely life, I would think, but from what my grandfather indicated, they were very kindly treated, and religion wasn't, they weren't ostracized at all because of the religion, they were just different.
Did they practice their religion?
Yes, they went, of course, Richmond was not an easy trip in those
days.
How far
is it from Richmond again?
It was about 70 miles.
And
at 6 miles an hour by horse or carriage, it was an all-day trip. But he maintained his affiliation with the congregation during the period he was in Keysville, and when obviously he had to go to Richmond on buying trips to purchase items for their store. So they would take a day to get to Richmond, and probably a day or two while he was in Richmond to purchase what he needed. And while he was there, he kept up his affiliation with the synagogue.
Do you know if they practiced Judaism in the home,
no.
Sabbath and all that? Yeah.
No, I presume that my great-grandparents did.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents did not. I know that. But I presume my great-grandparents did because they were the first generation. As far as my grandfather said, there were no other Jewish families anywhere in the county. And then in 1871, I should mention maybe what life was like in Keysville. From age 7 to 13, when he was old enough to remember what it was like growing up in that area, he went to a school which was a one-room log cabin. It was built by the parents of the children of school age. The custom in Virginia at that time, they had no public education. The custom was that people with children of school age would get together, build a either a frame building or log cabin, and hire a teacher, and the children would pay the teacher's salary, and some planter or plantation owner would donate the land on which to build the school. And that's the case here. And their teacher was the war ended, and he was a former Confederate major. When the war ended, many of the officers returned, and the country was impoverished. The tobacco had ruined the soil, overplanting, and there was no money. There was occupation by the federal troops after the war. It was Reconstruction, and they kept troops. The North kept troops in the South to ensure that the Negroes could have the right to vote. Women weren't allowed to vote, but the Negroes were. It was many years later before women got the right to vote in this country, which is very interesting.
Women got the right to vote what year? About 19, right after World War I.
Yeah, I think it was 1920 maybe, the right of women. So in 1871 or thereabouts, Blacks were enfranchised, and the my grandfather, whenever he wasn't in school, his uncle taught him to hunt and to shoot. He became an excellent shot, and they used to go out in the season. In the summer, they'd go out for rabbit and squirrels and game, upland game, pheasant, quail. And then in the wintertime, they'd shoot ducks and turkeys. There were deer, lots of deer, so There was plenty, and he loved to fish. He went fishing. He had a Chesapeake Retriever dog, which was his best companion. He named him after Jeb Stuart, the Civil War cavalryman. And Jeb was his dog, and he just loved his dog. And he read a lot. His mother, Minna, was her name, M-I-N-N-A, Minna Weil, had gone to school in Munich, in Germany. And from what my grandfather said, it was a very good school, and she was an educated woman and had my grandfather reading at an early age.
German or English?
Pardon?
German or English?
Oh, English.
English,
yes. In fact, I don't even know if my grandfather even spoke German. It was the custom in those days and continued on until really recently that when immigrants came to this country, the first thing they did was try to become as American as they could. And in many households, they wouldn't speak their native tongue in the house because they didn't want their children to either learn it or have an accent. That was the case with Peggy. When her parents came to this country, neither of them would speak Norwegian or Swedish in the house. And neither Peggy nor her brother knew a word of Norwegian or Swedish as they grew up.
Different than now.
Pardon?
Different than now.
Oh, yes, yeah. Very different.
That's very interesting.
And so I'm quite sure in those days there was a lot of anti-German feeling among the other. Large numbers of Germans were coming to this country in the 1840s. And I think there was a certain amount of nationalism. I mean, well, I know there was. The Know Nothing Party sprung up about it in the 1850s, which there was a lot of anti-foreign feeling at that time. So finally, during the period of Reconstruction following the Civil War, family was quite poor. The people were destitute. The large plantations were in ruin. Many of the slaves who were freed left the plantations and became sharecroppers. You know what sharecropping is, and that was very prevalent at that time following the Civil War.
Do you want to describe sharecropping? To the tape?
Yes, well, the plantation owners had no money and they couldn't afford to pay salaries or wages to their employees. But they had all this land that needed farming and tilling, so they made arrangements with the former slaves that if the slaves would continue to stay on the plantations and work, they would share in the crops that were produced by the former slaves.
Thank you.
And that's where the
word came from.
Word came, sharecropping. And of course, many of the slaves were not mistreated by their owners. They were treated kindly and had no place to go. They would have starved if they had left. So they remained on the plantations generally.
Now, did your great-grandparents, you mentioned they owned land,
They owned land on the land where they built their house. They had two former slaves that were given to them in payment for one of the planters, I presume, that they had sold many, goods to, didn't have the money, and slaves were like property. Well,
right,
they were
sure.
Property. The Supreme Court said they had no rights, they were personal property, and they were listed on the books in the county as property, and they were very valuable. They were probably the most valuable property that most of the property owners had. Would you stop there? I'm going to put on the sweaters.
Okay. Now,
they had 100 acres on which they raised, as almost every family in the South did, they raised vegetables, and they kept a cow, and they had horses, of course. Everybody had buggies. So they raised some grain and corn and vegetables, and they had chickens and cows, things like that. They immediately, when they got there, their slaves, they emancipated them. They gave them their freedom. And of course, they continued on working for my great-grandparents as employees. They were given a cabin on the ground. They had their own cabin, and they were paid money, given money, shared in the food. And like in the South, the wife of the wife would act, be cook, maid, nanny, become part of the family almost. And the man would work in the garden and help raise the crops and drive the buggy, and he had many jobs and duties, cut firewood, all that sort of thing. 1871, they decided to go north, that there was no future, people didn't have money to buy goods, conditions got worse and worse, so the Weil family up north had gone to Titusville, Pennsylvania, shortly after, in 1860, oil was discovered. And in the early 1860s, Titusville became a boom town. Titusville was just out in the boonies of western Pennsylvania, up in the mountains, and had a population of 15 or 20 people, and within a few years there were 10,000 people in Titusville. So people from all over flocked there to participate in the discovery of oil. My grandmother's two brothers, came and to Titusville and built a bottling plant where they made soft drinks, and also built and ran a hotel called the Hotel de Weil, if you can imagine.
Oh, I love it. Now, this is the family from Rochester.
Yeah, okay. I'll show you a picture.
Okay,
after.
Great. Yeah,
I have a picture of the hotel.
I love it.
And they were successful and had money and finally talked the family into moving north, which they did. So in 1871, my great-grandmother and father and their three children came to Titusville. And Titusville actually had 15,000 people then by 1871. And they had three public schools, including a high school where my grandfather was age 13 at that time. He then started in the high school. There was a large German population in Titusville, and enough of them were Jewish that they had a synagogue. So my great-grandfather opened a variety stationery and variety store. Apparently he surveyed to see what kind of a store was most needed, and they didn't have one, so he started one there. And my grandfather, as I said, started in high school, and for his age, and I guess all through his life, he was not a large, he was a small person. He was maybe full grown, he was slightly under 5'7". And as a boy, he was a small boy, so he had to learn to defend himself, because coming from the South, right after the Civil War, you can imagine, being he was a rebel, He was a southerner, he still had his southern accent then, which later in life he got rid of.
Did he?
But he had a southern accent, so they made fun of him. They made fun of his name, and he was small.
Poor
so
kid.
He had a terrible time. Yes, he had constant fights, but he said his Uncle Samuel had taught him hand-to-hand combat. So he was able to he was pretty scrappy and could hold his own.
Let me ask you one question.
Yes.
You mentioned there was a synagogue in Titusville. Do you, by any chance, know the name of it?
Yes. It was B apostrophe N A I Zion.
Okay.
Reformed Jewish Congregation.
Isn't that interesting?
It no longer exists. But there is a graveyard there. The Jewish cemetery is there, but the congregation doesn't exist. There was a huge flood in Titusville some years after the family left, and a large number of the Jewish settlers there located in one particular area, and they were wiped out when the flood came. Their homes were all destroyed, and some of them lost their life.